Guys, you should write a book together.
No, my book would be about Nate. It would be exposing all the dark secrets of 538.
I wish I had dark secrets. It'd be more exciting.
Yeah, there aren't really any dark secrets.
My Ramona Clef about my time here is going to be great.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we've got a treat for you today. We're releasing our 538 approved polling averages of the early states later this week, but we're going to give you a preview today. So essentially, we'll be able to share the best picture we can of where the Democratic primary is in the first four states and the nation based on all of the polling out there. We're also going to return to an exercise we've done several times during President Trump's tenure. Shortly after Trump was inaugurated, Nate wrote a piece called 14 versions of Trump's presidency, from hashtag MAGA to impeachment. We've checked back in with those 14 different versions over the past 3 years to see which most reflects reality, and we're going to do that again today. And here with me to do all that, as usual, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going well.
Senior politics writer, Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good.
Happy Monday.
Thank you. You too.
And managing editor, Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very nice. I'm just realizing now Nate and I are kind of wearing the same shirt today.
Oh, you are?
I mean, there are only so many men's shirts.
Not a lot of variety in men's fashion. Yeah.
Not a lot of variety in men's fashion.
You can be sure that at any business casual event, you will have almost 50% of the men show up in blue check shirts.
Meanwhile, I'm wearing a large buffalo check overcoat.
Very nice.
Wasn't really worried about you guys.
I mean, I almost wore my buffalo check overcoat today, so...
Galen, for podcast listeners, Galen's got a nice little denim going number. Here.
It kind of looks like the male version of like a Charlie's Angels jumpsuit. It's kind of like a zip up.
That's definitely what I was going for.
Yeah.
All right. Let's begin with our yet to be released early state polling averages. As of this morning, here is where things stand. And this is going to be a lot of numbers. So prepare yourselves. I'll try to make it easy on the ears. Nationally, Biden leads with 26%, followed by Sanders at 16%, Warren at 15%, and Buttigieg at 10%. In Iowa, Buttigieg leads with 24%, then Sanders at 18%, followed by Biden, and then Warren. In New Hampshire, Biden and Sanders are tied at 19%, again followed by Biden, then Warren. In Nevada, Biden leads with 26%, followed by Sanders at 19%, then Warren, then Buttigieg. Lastly, in South Carolina, Biden leads with 38%, Sanders at 13%, and Warren and Buttigieg follow in the single digits. So, a lot to process there, but let's start here. Nate, other sites have had polling averages out for a while. What do we do differently that we think adds value in all of this?
Yeah, Nate, how do you add value to society?
What's your raison d'etre?
Zero shade to like medium shade to high shade.
Try to do it modestly. Yeah, try to pull yourself up without pushing each other's down first.
Good life advice from Claire Malone there.
If you had a polling average, wouldn't you want it to be calibrated empirically?
No.
It would actually...
Don't do it in this faux, modest, but really mocking tone. Do it.
So there are a lot of things you have to think about when building a polling average. And they're actually more relevant probably in the primaries than in the general election, because polls tend to vary more from one another. In the primaries, you can see big, rather sharp shifts, right? So it's just, there's a lot of questions about like, how much should I weight recent polls versus previous polls? How much should I shift if there's an apparent big swing? That's a related question, right? How much should I adjust for house effects? We know certain pollsters, Emerson College, for example, tends to have good results for Warren and Sanders relative to Biden. How much to adjust for that? And we have just spent a lot of time with those questions and think we have answers that do a really good job of kind of, sorry for the little self-plug here, but like detecting signal and avoiding noise and kind of moving.
Is that a book?
It's a wonderful
this
book.
This guy wrote, I don't remember his name, but that's some guy book. Back
still
in 2012.
Available? You know, that's kind of clever thing we do is that we actually use, because there are more national polls than there are early state polls. So we can use the same thing we actually do in our general election models, which is use a trend line from national polls to make inferences about early state polls. So let's say we know, as kind of is the case now, that like Elizabeth Warren has declined by several points nationally, but there aren't very many recent South Carolina or Nevada polls, or for that matter, really not that many Iowa or New Hampshire polls, right? We can't anticipate the decline she'll also probably experience in national polls, because that tends to be correlated with the decline you would see in state polls. The state, you know, the nation is made up of the 50 states and the District of Columbia.
I want to get a little bit more into the methodology maybe as we go through this, but just to set the table here, Claire, how does seeing these state averages change your thinking about the state of the Democratic primary race compared to, you know, a few weeks ago when we didn't have this information?
Well, I mean, in some ways it's showing a little bit of what we've already been seeing, which is like Biden leads nationally, but in these first couple of states, he's weak. But then when you go to the more diverse states, South Carolina and Nevada, which come next, although in reverse order, Nevada, then South Carolina, he's doing pretty well, or the race is different, right? Sanders is doing better in Nevada, you know. So I guess, like, you know, sitting here in early December, it just makes me think that I have truly no idea who's going to win the primary. And I think there'll be a much better idea by the beginning of March about who's, you know, who's doing well. Like, I think the nature of this race is so interesting right now because there is such a difference between the early states that are largely white and then the later states, which have a more diverse population, where obviously Biden is doing better. We've been spending a lot of time talking for the past couple of years about the differing political tastes, basically, of, you know, college-educated whites versus whites without a college education or minorities in the Democratic Party. And to me, the difference between the national polling versus those first two states is so interesting. And it's just it is the bifurcation of the Democratic ideological back and forth kind of encapsulated.
Yeah, looking at the charts that our beautiful Viz team made of these polling averages, a few things jump out.
Wait, is the Viz team beautiful or the charts beautiful?
Both. They're both beautiful. Okay, so one, the national chart isn't too surprising to me, but Buttigieg's climb in New Hampshire and particularly Iowa really jumps out, where our polling averages now show Buttigieg with a decent-sized lead in Iowa. By no means an impregnable lead, you know, but a decent-sized lead. Going the other way, Warren's decline is really clear in Iowa and New Hampshire. Much of that is inferred from national polls, Nate?
Yeah, so it's saying, and we've tested this empirically, if there's a shift in national polls, then you should assume, all other things being equal, that it more or less translates in a fairly linear way to state polls.
Say that in layman's terms.
If a candidate goes from 16 to 13 in national polls, and she was at 20 in Iowa, you'd expect her to be at 17.
Wait, right? Can I ask one question about that? Because part of our value add during the general election in 2016 was realizing that certain states move distinctly from the nation or from other states, right? You can kind of group them together based on the demographics within a particular state. Do we have to take that into consideration? Like, Iowa may move differently from the nation just because it's not actually representative of the nation as a whole.
If there are a lot of recent state polls, and that will essentially kind of override the national trend, right? That's mostly for when you have only older, out-of-date state polling, or you have a lot of new national polling and hasn't translated to the state level yet. The question about, like, how important is it to account for correlations between different states is, like, it's not quite as important, or maybe it's not really that important at all, because you're not worried about a particular configuration of states, right? It's not like, oh, if Warren wins Iowa and Minnesota and Wisconsin, then she wins the Electoral College. There is no Electoral College. Everything is kind of proportional, right? And so therefore, like, you know, we're going to work on, for the full-fledged model, which is something related to but different, this, we're thinking about if that's even important to look at. But that's not as much of a consideration. It's more like, yes, if you have, like, lots of polls in a state, then that's going to be the most important thing. If you have out-of-date polling, then, and we've tested this again, you know, it's by far better to adjust than to pretend that, oh, magically there's a trend nationally that we're not seeing in the state level. And in fact, like, we've been testing this internally for a few weeks now, occasionally been tweeting the numbers. We have seen when there have been polls of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, the number of people think are very bearish for Warren often bear out, and she's at those numbers or even a bit lower when actual polls come out. So it's doing a good job of, like, anticipating where the trends are.
I guess the one thing I will say, just sort of the new thing that's sticking out to me as I'm looking at this data is, I've talked a lot to campaigns who are not the leaders, right, who are struggling maybe, and everyone always says, well, you just got to peak at the right time, right? Or like, you know, it's, you know, we might be behind now, but like we're betting on like peaking in the fall or like raising our numbers. To me, what is striking is to see Buttigieg's numbers, you know, if you're looking at the national average, kind of steadily going up from like mid-October. And then in just the last couple weeks, there's like this sharp uptick, which is really striking to me.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, you've certainly seen Warren specifically go after Buttigieg, right? And Buttigieg kind of said, well, like, well, I guess that means she takes me seriously, right? You know, like, so to me, that's the most interesting little thread to pick up here. You know, obviously it could go a number of different ways.
Well, you have, of the four front runners, you have two very steady candidates. Like, one thing about our averages when you see them is that the numbers for Biden and Sanders are incredibly steady.
Yeah.
And we think these little fluctuations back and forth between 30 and 25 for Biden and Real Clear Politics, we think that's just noise that a more sophisticated algorithm would avoid. Conversely, you see big swings for Harris, now departed from the race, Kamala Harris, as well as Warren and Buttigieg. And so somehow they're like, they all kind of trade off with one another and impact one another. And these other two, the two really old white guys, seem to have their fairly steady basis of support. And because there's so many gyrations in the rest of the race, like, you know, Biden and Bernie look better, even though they haven't really improved their numbers much, just because everyone else is so fluctuating around. They look like it looks pretty good all of a sudden now. All of a sudden, 26% looks pretty good for Biden, and 17% for Bernie looks pretty good, right?
Well, that's
even though he hasn't really improved very much in either case.
That's the other thing that really jumped out at me. Well, one is what Claire was saying. The Buttigieg bump, which is like very not linear, it's all of a sudden corresponds perfectly with
a Warren sharp decline. Yes,
right?
Yes.
And do we know from looking at the polls that they are kind of duking it out over the same stock of voters? People have switched their minds from supporting Warren to now supporting Buttigieg?
Yeah, partially, yes. College-educated whites, I think, are in the crosshairs for both candidates. The other thing, and maybe this jumped out at me more than anyone else from just seeing these averages on charts, is Sanders is doing pretty freaking good. He is in second place in Iowa right now, according to our average, essentially tied for the lead in New Hampshire, second place in Nevada, second place in South Carolina.
And second place nationally.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting about that, I think that maybe is something that our listeners or readers will be a little bit surprised by, in part because I think that hasn't been the prevailing media narrative, right? I think we have been all really caught up in the Buttigieg Warren sort of battle royale. And Drew Malmetta, who is on our staff and who has been writing these really interesting media coverage, state of the race columns, He last week showed me a little tidbit that was basically like Sanders has kind of been undercovered by the media vis-a-vis his polling numbers. So there is something to that phenomenon of maybe we're not paying as much attention to him.
So here's the question. Is not covering Sanders as much relative to his polling average justified in that there are some legitimate reasons to think, I forget who, Nate, maybe you phrased it this way, which I liked, which was not so much that his ceiling is lower, but that maybe Sanders' ceiling is harder for him to reach than other candidate ceilings. Does that justify not covering Sanders as much
as a
factional candidate or no?
So let me say a few different things. Definitely when people, we've tweeted these numbers out, people are like, oh, they have the same reaction that you did, that, oh, Sanders is doing kind of better than I would have thought. And he's in, you know, second place in all these states. I actually think kind of being in second place isn't worth very much. I think being in a distant second place relative to Biden is not worth that much. And being in second versus third doesn't matter very much. And if you look at who gets a bounce in a state, basically winning matters. And like second versus third versus fourth doesn't really mean much. People will look at the number you get, but the ordinal rank after first doesn't matter.
What about Marco Rubio's strong third place finish in Iowa?
John Huntsman's ticket to ride third place in New Hampshire. He actually dropped out before South Carolina. I mean, look, either Sanders or Warren is close enough to Biden that if they were to win Iowa and New Hampshire, I don't know if it's an and or, it's probably an Iowa, and then you probably also do win New Hampshire if you're one of those two and you win Iowa. Like, they would probably catch or overtake him, although then you get to kind of philosophical stuff about, like, yeah, is Bernie a factional candidate? Whereas Buttigieg might not. I mean, to me, the big story is, like, as I've been kind of building the models, like the steadiness of Biden, really. Because like I said, neither Biden or Bernie have really moved very much. But like, you know, all of a sudden we're going to start voting in less than 2 months. But yeah, I mean, Bernie needs to win Iowa. It's a problem for Sanders and Warren if Buttigieg wins Iowa. People are like, oh, it's a problem if Biden loses Iowa. No, it's actually a bigger problem for Warren or Sanders because they're behind Biden. And by the way, Iowa ought to be a relatively good state for them. Bernie almost won it last time. Warren has been ahead in the polls there at earlier points in the campaign, right? So if they don't win Iowa, then all of a sudden everyone, all three of the frontrunners would suffer and Buttigieg would gain, right? But still, they're below Biden to begin with. And so, you know, anyway, we're getting into territory in the model and not the polling average. It is true that if you have Bernie winning Iowa, then his averages are close enough where that might be enough to put him in the lead, or also or at least pretty close nationally. And, you know, Bernie is drawing from a coalition that it's like a little bit more well-balanced than last time. It's also smaller than last time. He won 43% of the vote last time, right? But his numbers are actually reasonably steady across different states. And so, therefore, he would turn in a respectable performance in each of the first four, probably stay over 15%, which means you get delegates. And so Bernie's numbers are impressive in their steadiness, really.
All right, we're going to continue digging into these numbers, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by Hims. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, just prescription solutions backed by science. Hims was created by a guy who knows that some men's health conversations are easier online than in person. No more awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. 4hims connects you to real doctors online, which could save you hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. Answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that's shipped directly to your door. Try Hims today by starting out with a free online visit. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's FORHIMS.com/538. Prescription products are subject to doctor approval and require an online consultation with a physician who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went in person to the doctor's office or pharmacy. Remember, that's 4hims.com/538. All right, we're back, and we've talked a lot about Biden's support from black voters in South Carolina, but he's also doing pretty well in Nevada, where he has a clear lead with 26% of the vote. So what are the dynamics of voters' preferences in Nevada that is kind of giving him that strength?
I think a big thing to remember about Nevada is it's also a caucus state, and unions are very important in the Nevada caucuses. They're a huge organizing force. There was a huge fight in the last Democratic primary over basically the endorsement from the culinary, I think it's a culinary association, whatever it is. Basically, like, all the casinos have a large numbers of service workers, and the unions really turn those people out to caucus during the day. So I think the idea that Biden has nursed a the working class Grant and Joe reputation as friend of the union man is something that very much works to his credit. I also think Nevada has a, especially in the Democratic primary electorate, a high number of Latino voters, and they are, minority voters in the Democratic Party tend to favor Joe Biden. I think you get into, it's not the same dynamic as black voters feeling this kind of fealty to Biden because of the Obama connection. But I do think it gets into this pragmatism of, A, people see Biden is more electable in the era of Donald Trump, and B, Latino voters, like black voters, tend to be more moderate or conservative Democrats, which Biden is.
Yeah. I mean, is that similar to what you're saying?
I mean, I don't really see particular strength for Biden in Nevada. I see his numbers being the same as they are nationally. And his numbers nationally are decent. They're 26%, and he's about there in Nevada, right? Biden has a lot of coalitions that like him. They happen to not be present in great numbers in Iowa and New Hampshire. But to me, the candidate who actually is, I think that's where Bernie's numbers are the most impressive, is Nevada. Because he's at like 20% there versus like 17 or 16% in our national average. So he's overperforming by 4 or 5 points. And that's nice, right? That might mean that if he's able to win New Hampshire, that he can follow it up with a win in Nevada, which is a more diverse state and would answer a lot of questions, including our own, about how broad his coalition can be. I think that is partly like the union support. But like the key thing is, like, I like to look at every state, and this is kind of how the model works, you know, every state relative to the national trend. So Nevada being the most similar to the demographics of the electorate overall is actually the most similar of the first four states to the national polls. However, you see Sanders doing a little bit better there, which is a well-timed strength for him. And that's been fairly consistent, although we don't have that many Nevada polls. But I think it's the union and organizing thing.
There was also a this is not Nevada. It was a poll of California, I think, done by Latino Decisions of Latino voters in California that found Sanders leading among those voters. 31% would vote for Sanders. Biden was in second at 22%. Warren, 11%. Castro, 9%. Harris, recently departed, 8%. I'm not sure that's surprising, but it's certainly noteworthy that Sanders had, you know, a 10-point lead essentially over Biden among Latino voters in California.
I mean, should we talk a little bit about the harangue that I think 538 sometimes has about Nevada polling? It's not good.
There also hasn't been that much of it, as Nate said.
Well, none of the polling in the primaries is much good.
After a 30-minute conversation
about
polls.
And that's all you're getting, people.
I mean, getting the sense of results-wise, right, it's as good as it can be, but, like, people change their minds, and Nevada's a caucus, and, like, I mean, I think there is often difficulty polling Latino voters in particular, which is relevant in a lot of the western states. And the ones we have seen, even polls that try to break out a larger sample of Hispanics, often differ
why
in the relative strengths of the.
Why is there trouble polling Latino voters?
For a lot of reasons. One is that in some states, you still have some who are primarily Spanish-speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And employing Spanish language interviewers is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Also, just traditionally, white people answer their phones more from strangers. I don't know why. Maybe just a kind of white things white people like is answering phone calls from random numbers.
I'm sure there and are a lot of complicated reasons for that, but yeah.
I'm sure there are a lot of complicated reasons for it. But all minority groups tend to be underrepresented in polls and therefore have to be upweighted, right? Which means that if you don't find enough Latinos, you know, you should based on the population, then you have to weight the ones you do find heavily. Also, Latinos are a young population and young people in general are harder to reach. And finally, one more thing, like because Latinos tend to be different from community to community based on
country
where you are geographically, country of origin, how many generations you've been here and other factors that like you can't necessarily with weighting solve for the fact that you get Latinos, but only a certain type of Latino voter, and you're underrepresenting a different type. Say someone who speaks Spanish, who is newer to the country, or someone who's Puerto Rican instead of Mexican or something. Like, these are fairly big challenges.
Yeah, and just to give people a sense, there were only two polls of Nevada in November, two in October, two in September.
Yeah.
That's versus, like, Iowa and New Hampshire, which are just, like, battered with polls.
So to Nate's point about like primary polls in general are not all that accurate, certainly as compared to general election polls. Nate, so Buttigieg has a 6-point lead basically on Sanders in Iowa. How should people look at that? Like, is that in our polling average? Is that a safe lead? Obviously not, but how unsafe is it?
It's not. I mean, first of all, it's not even remotely safe given that there are almost 2 months to go.
Yeah.
Even on election day, it would not be particularly safe. I think the model would say, okay, I mean, in a caucus, God forbid, right?
Yeah.
In a caucus, the margin of error on these numbers is 12 points or something, right? The average error might be 6 or 7 points. So it's kind of the normal size polling error away. It'd be that. And also have complications about like how are different candidates related, right? If Buttigieg underperforms, who overperforms, who's correlated, it gets a little complicated. That's part of what we're trying to figure out. But like, but none of these leads in the early states are safe, except maybe Biden in South Carolina.
Yeah. Can I just say one last thing about Nevada, which is the really striking thing when you go to the early states in Iowa, New Hampshire, it is just, it's almost like a joke how much politics and the primaries and everyone's there covering it. And the voters feel very entitled and aware of their power. And covering the Nevada caucuses in 2016 was so interesting because, you know, a lot of the actual caucus, how people caucus is you're in these big like casino hotel conference rooms and there's like really long lines of culinary workers. But then you literally go anywhere else and people are like, oh, there's like a caucus today. You know, it's just like it's not there's not the awareness within the state about like, oh, there's like actually a big thing that makes a difference here, whereas in like Iowa, New Hampshire, it is so their thing. And Nevada is just kind of like, well, we're in Vegas and like there's a lot of other stuff going on. But I do actually think that that dynamic makes a difference because that I think it speaks to the outsize effects that the culinary workers have on these caucuses.
They can organize. And it goes to the point of like these primaries and particularly caucuses, people have to get used to the idea that, look, a 6 or 7 point lead in a general election is relatively safe. I mean, those candidates will lose occasionally. But in a primary, because of the stuff Claire is talking about, where like turnout can be really low, caucuses are bonkers, you know.
And people can change their minds quickly because they're all
Democrats.
There's
also a dynamic process where if you don't get 15%, then you can go join other candidates' group. But yeah, I mean, that's right about Nevada. And it's also a state where like in general, you have a lot of people moving from other parts of the country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so anytime you have a state like that, voter participation tends to be low. And so whichever candidate is investing in Nevada ground game and or gets union endorsements and or gets endorsements of kind of the Harry Reid machine, right? Like that candidate could way overperform. I mean, a little bit of the problem in Nevada, the flip side of this is because the media finds it so weird that it tends not to produce big bounces relative to other states.
I mean, you've seen this already, right? Nevada is the third state to vote. It comes before South Carolina. We've talked far more about South Carolina than Nevada.
Well, we've been trying to... One thing you have to figure out for the model is like how much of a bounce does each state produce?
Right.
And after the first four, then it's kind of proportional to the delegates in the state. It's a little bit more rational, right? For the first four, as far as we can tell in testing the model, Nevada and South Carolina are about one-fifth as important as Iowa. And so
that's crazy.
If anything, we're kind of cheating up a little bit on Nevada, but like there's not a lot of years in which it's been kind of in this first four order. But like typically it doesn't produce that much momentum per se.
The one thing I'm actually just a couple more things on Nevada. The one thing I'm sort of curious to see is whether or not Warren gets any surge. She has a big national team. I think she has a decently easy connection to labor if you're going to make that, although probably a little bit tougher than sort of Biden or Sanders. But service unions tend to have a lot of women in them. I think Americans' conceptions of unions is typically like the Teamsters, which was obviously super male, right? That is not the case with service workers. There has been it's been less covered, but there's actually quite a lot of sexual assault of service workers or poor working conditions for working mothers. And the Me Too movement did kind of have a little bit, if it did have kind of a splash as far as like working class women went, it was talking about sort of like the danger that sort of working in hotels, for instance, or in bars or casinos where people might see women in service roles as kind of like there for the taking. That was a real moment in the past couple of years. So I'm curious if a woman, Warren, speaking to unionized service workers who have where the numbers are a decent number of women, I wonder if that could have any effect. And I think that that's a sort of a potential strategic advantage or a potential dynamic that could surface in the race.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Reno Gazette is tracking endorsements in Nevada. And according to their tracking of more local endorsements than we would in our endorsement tracker, Warren is getting more endorsements than, for example, Sanders. I mean, Biden definitely leads there by a significant number, but local members of the Democratic Party, local representatives are endorsing Warren. And also, I've seen interviews with Harry Reid where he's talked about Warren somewhat as, you know, his protege, somebody
glowing.
He put a lot of faith in bringing her into the Obama administration during his time in office.
Yeah, I believe you made me aware of this article in The Atlantic. Isaac Dovray did an interview with Harry Reid, who has obviously been ill. But, you know, the author asks, do you think Bernie Sanders, I believe he has, like, would Bernie Sanders make a good president? And Reid kind of demurs a bit. You know, he says nice things, but demurs. And then the author asks the same thing about Warren. And he says, oh, yes, very smart, you know, very organized. Oh, you know, basically, yes, an outright yes, she would be a good president. And that is an interesting kind of like smoke signal from, you know, the
such
Harry.
A power, also, a looming figure in Nevada.
If you talk about, okay, well, Bernie is not a Democrat technically. And what's that mean? Who really cares or not? Right. Someone who might care about that is the former Senate Majority and Minority Leader, Harry Reid, who probably thought that Bernie was sometimes a great progressive voice and sometimes a big pain in his ass, right? And so, you know, there might not be a lot of love lost if that becomes important.
We're going to move on to our next segment, but just to wrap up here, Nate, we're shining a spotlight on the averages in the first four states right now. For listeners who want to get a sense of kind of the state of the race, would you encourage them to pay more attention to the national polls at this point or state level averages?
I mean, kind of a blend, you know, you can, it shouldn't be that hard.
Read all my work. What's the best use like, how should you go? You're on 538. Where do you go to be a smart reader of our polling averages? Where do you start?
Everywhere.
Give us page views. Click on all the different tabs.
Where do you go? Do you start at the national polling average?
Okay. You want a little trick?
Yes.
Podcast exclusive.
Okay.
Take the average of national polls and Iowa polls, and that's not too bad.
Okay.
Just the average of those two.
All right.
That's not bad.
I have a related question. Should we pay any attention to the later states after the early states, or are they going to change so much that it's not worth paying? Just go Iowa.
I mean, the polls change when there are surprises, and we can kind of get into questions about kind of what is meant by surprises. I mean, and we can have a whole other episode about like bounces that are produced. I mean, again, the thing that's pretty robust is the relative placement of candidates in states relative to their national numbers, right?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So California, for example, actually is another state that looks a little weak for Biden. That's pretty significant, potentially. It means that if Biden falls to 17% nationally, then he might not actually hit 15% in many of the congressional districts in California, which would mean that, therefore, he misses out on a bunch of delegates. So it's the relative order of the states relative to the national numbers that I think is important.
Gotcha. All right, let's move on and discuss which of Nate's 14 paths Trump's presidency has taken. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by DoorDash. Long day at work, tough day at school, still stuck at the office? Treat yourself to the meal you deserve and have your favorite restaurants come to you with DoorDash. DoorDash connects you to your favorite restaurants in your city. Ordering is easy. Open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food will be delivered to you wherever you are. Not only is your favorite pizza joint already on DoorDash, but there are over 340,000 restaurants in 3,300 cities, so you might find a new favorite too. With door-to-door delivery in all 50 states and Canada, order from your local go-tos or choose from your favorite national restaurants. Don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code POLITICS. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code POLITICS. Don't forget, that's promo code POLITICS for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538. A week or so into Trump's presidency, Nate wrote a piece called 14 versions of Trump's presidency from hashtag MAGA to impeachment. We've looked back on it periodically over the past 3 years to help gauge how Trump's presidency is going. And we haven't done that since Democrats' impeachment push began. So today is the day. And Nate, again, just to start off here, what were you trying to capture by describing these 14 different paths in early February of 2017?
Well, I was trying to capture, in some sense, was uncertainty and to think about how many different paths were plausible within history or different sets of assumptions we knew about Trump. It was kind of a little bit trying to push back on people who thought they knew it all about exactly how the presidency would unfold, given its unprecedented nature in many ways. So it's just a matter of you can't, like, build a model of a presidency. You can't say, okay, well, let's kind of plug these numbers in and here's, you know, here's the 95th probability distribution. You can't do that. It's too complicated. It's not how the world works, right? But it still can be a helpful exercise to think about. Let's think about the contingencies and a reasonable range of outcomes and maybe put some in the more likely or less likely bucket.
All right, so we're going to go through these 14 paths and see what's off the table at this point, what turned out to be relatively indicative of what would happen. And there are five different subgroups, so we're going to go group by group. And it begins with group one, extrapolations from the status quo. And the three paths there are Trump keeps on trumping and the country remains evenly divided. Two, Trump gradually or not so gradually enters a death spiral. And three, Trump keeps rewriting the political rules and gradually becomes more popular. Of that group, what has borne out in reality?
I think it's like 70% one, Trump keeps on trumping and the country remains evenly divided. And 30% two, Trump gradually enters a death spiral.
I think it's one.
I think it's one. Fully.
Fully one? But Trump is not popular.
Well, but...
But it's more...
When I wrote this, what was he... I mean, I guess it's pre-Comey. It's really 43%. Now he's at 41.5% approval rating-wise. You certainly could not make any type of claim that there has been a decline. I mean, the overwhelmingly obvious conclusion is the steadiness in his approval ratings.
Excuse me. When you wrote this, February 3rd, Nate Silver, and on February 3rd, 2017... Trump's approval rating was 44% approve, 47% disapprove.
Which is like literally the highest that it ever was, because presidents typically have a honeymoon period in their first month or so. Trump was in that period, right? So like the minute you kind of get out of that honeymoon and you have stuff actually happening, then he's down to about where he is now.
So you're saying he's become more unpopular?
I'm saying that like, look at the freaking chart. Are we taping this episode?
Yeah, all
look
right.
Look at the chart, people.
YouTube watchers.
You could like
click and subscribe so you can see Nate pointing at a screen.
Guys, you could like balance a vase. Okay, I mean like I'm exaggerating the steadiness of these lines, but you could like balance like a delicate crystalline object or something.
Almost. All right. It gets more interesting as we move on. So group two, the subheading is Trump changes direction, and that includes path four, Trump mellows out slightly. Five, Trump cedes authority basically to other people in his administration. Six, Trump successfully pivots to the populist center, but with plenty of authoritarianism too. And then seven, Trump flails around aimlessly after an unsuccessful attempt to pivot.
Seven.
Zero. None of these.
Seven matches it the most. It's seven describes him firing lots of people. I guess he hasn't alienated allies that much.
Well, yeah, because it's assumed that he has like pissed off Mitch McConnell and people, and he hasn't done that, and that seems an important factor. And I mean, I'm sure
but by the extent to which he has, it's not.
Another reason why I say seven is by early 2019, there are impeachment proceedings against Trump. Although the second half of it is, and several Republicans are considering challenging him.
That's true too.
That's true. Although it's not.
Okay, I mean,
why
did really?
Why didn't you see the future? Yeah, William Weld.
Yeah, I agree. He certainly has not mellowed out. He has certainly not devolved authority to lieutenants. If anything, he's tried to consolidate his power. He's certainly not pulled off any type of successful or unsuccessful pivot to the center. And
There have been hot seconds. Remember?
Nate was on hashtag pivot bandwagon.
Remember when he was going to be friends with Chuck and Nancy?
Yeah, there was a moment. That's right, yeah. But still, I think none of these really have held true for more than 24 hours at a time, you know.
Well, is it fair to say that he pivoted away from the most conventional establishment Republican figures that filled out his administration early on?
Well, he also pivoted, yes, but he also pivoted away from like Bannon, although Stephen Miller is still there. Yeah. I don't know. It's probably more Bannon, Stephen Miller than it is
Brent Priebus.
Right, exactly.
I think he, can you pivot back in on yourself? Can you
double down?
Yeah, self.
I mean, that's the point of the pivot foot, right, Micah? Is that you can turn in all directions without traveling.
We're pivoting to ourselves. That's true. Pivoting to be more like ourselves.
It was more of like a step ball change than a pivot.
What is that?
What is that?
A dance move?
No, yeah. I was talking basketball.
No? Okay, never mind. Clearly, you guys were not in musical theater growing up.
No, I wasn't.
All right.
Clearly you were.
Let's move on to group three, which
clearly I was playing basketball.
Claire and I are on the basketball now, actually. Keep your pivot foot, people.
All right. Group three, the three horsemen of the presidential apocalypse, war, recession, and scandal. So, path eight, Trump is consumed by scandal. Nine, Trump is undermined by a failure to deliver jobs. And 10, Trump's law and order agenda is bolstered by an international incident or terrorist attack.
8, Trump is consumed by scandal and relatively little of 9 and 10.
I agree with that.
Look, consumed is kind of a loaded word there, but no policy really is getting done in the nation's capital. It's all impeachment. It's all scandal.
Like, what is Trump's? Like, yeah, what is Trump's legacy? Like, what are his policy?
It's the wall and the judicial stuff.
Trade, right? There's the possibility for USMCA to pass, right? There's the possibility for a new China-U.S. trade deal.
But it's telling that we're about to enter 2020, and you're talking about the possibility, right? Yeah. Not a lot has gotten done. But on the jobs one, you know, 9, Trump is undermined by a failure to deliver jobs. What was striking to me about actually this whole exercise, going back and looking at this, you know, these are bucketed into relatively clean narratives, which makes sense. I don't know how else you would do it. But what's striking is how our current reality really borrows from very distinct narratives. So on the one hand, you have a pretty healthy, booming economy. We just had this great jobs report. On the other hand, you have an administration consumed by scandal.
Which do you think matters more in defining the Trump presidency up until now?
What or what?
Scandal or economy?
I would take an average of both.
I would say scandal.
Yeah. Why is that?
I think it's the more graspable, culturally sustained image of the Trump presidency. And while the economy is doing well, there's an entire presidential primary that is in part preoccupied with the idea that the economy is deeply screwed up for the middle class. And so I do think that the Democrats have done a decent job, which I think was shown in the midterms, of convincing voters that the policies of the Republican administration is kind of like anti-middle class.
I also think Trump's approval rating bears a closer resemblance to what you would expect of a presidency defined by scandal than what you would expect of a presidency defined by a booming economy.
Look, it is always worth keeping in mind that Trump won in the Electoral College, did not win the popular vote, and that the GOP controls the Senate in part because Wyoming has as many senators as California. And so, you know, you can't describe kind of the Trump movement in the same way you would kind of actually popular populist movement in another country. He is not very popular. He has a chance to win re-election because of reasons related to our system, where it's a two-party system. The other party might nominate another unpopular candidate. And we think the Electoral College gives Trump an edge where he wins a lot of the close races, even the not-so-close ones. I mean, 2016 was not that close, right, in the popular vote. So, you know, these things are very important to keep in mind, and it's why we can say, fundamentally, Trump is an unpopular president, and that is very important in defining kind of his legacy and what he means for American history, right? However, that doesn't mean he's necessarily a big underdog, if an underdog at all, for re-election.
Yeah.
So please keep that in mind.
All right, so motoring along, we're on to group 4, and the two tracks under group 4 are 11, Trump plunges America into outright authoritarianism, 12, resistance to Trump from elsewhere in the government undermines his authority but prompts a constitutional crisis.
Nate, a little prescient there.
Yeah, 12, both of these.
Yeah, 12 was interesting.
I don't think 11's prescient.
I'm talking about 12.
12, yeah. 12 is a 12? One I would have in my sauce.
Wait
yeah.
a second. I think there's wisps of 11 here, too.
Like what?
Well, let's do the one that's actually true.
Excuse me. Trump is being impeached right now for trying to solicit a foreign country to interfere in our election help him.
But that's not outright authoritarianism.
We have not reached a lot of what Trump has gotten in trouble for is behaving.
Is anti-democratic behavior. Sure. But I think, to me, what jumps out from the page more to me is the idea that essentially, like, the revolt of the bureaucrats via the State Department employees choosing to break with the White House saying that no one from the executive branch.
The whistleblower,
no one should testify. And all these people have gone before the Intelligence Committee and said, this guy is, like, to your point, acting in an anti-democratic way, but to me it's more like the whistleblower needed to happen in order for that to be more fully revealed.
To see a lot of it. Yeah.
I mean, Comey refusing to, you know, exactly follow the president on the Russia investigation. I mean, I don't know. No, look, I think we could do a whole podcast on in which ways Trump is authoritarian and not. That's a very complicated one. One thing that I think is relatively uncontroversial is that he's closer to being authoritarian than the typical American president of the recent past. I also tend to think that if liberals had put together a list of things that 3 years into Trump's presidency they would define as clear signs of authoritarian behavior, not just everything they don't like about Trump, right? Some of which does not fall in this category, but things that they would describe as authoritarian, and they put that list in a time capsule, I think some of those boxes would be checked. Mm-hmm. I think many of them would not be checked. I don't know. Maybe we should do an episode on that.
Well, in your piece, Nate, you link to a foreign policy piece that has a checklist that's basically like 10 ways to tell if your president is a dictator, written in November 2016 after Trump won. And it's kind of what you're saying. It's there's not a ton of slam dunk, oh, Trump is defined by doing this, you know, systematic efforts to intimidate the media.
Check.
Check, right? You know, has Trump jailed journalists? No, but he certainly tried to intimidate them. Anyway, if you go through that list, it's kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, actually, maybe there is a few. Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons why we chose to do this segment, though, is like because we haven't checked in on Trump all that much outside the context of the Democratic Party, right? And talking about like who can beat Trump. But it is interesting now that we're talking about it to think through what would our December 2016 brains have thought about what's happening now, right? Would we be shocked by it? Would we feel that was to be expected?
I think both, right? It's like
it has been both a steady state of violations of norms, but also some of the stuff is surprising. The Saudi stuff was surprising to me.
The particulars are surprising.
The way, the specificity of, you know, manifestation of like perhaps authoritarian strains in Trump, is interesting.
I think the specific use, though, of the word authoritarianism gets at whether or not the American structure of checks and balances is working, or if the president has the ability to basically enact policies or wishes and our system of checks and balances doesn't actually work. And I think, you know, we had a podcast earlier in the year with Kate Shaw just talking about impeachment generally, but we talked about what constitutes a constitutional crisis. President Trump has followed the courts every time they've made a ruling. Even with Nixon, there were questions about whether or not he would follow court orders. President Trump clearly has so far. When it comes to what he has and hasn't been able to do in terms of the Muslim ban, et cetera, he's had to change his policies in accordance with the court and what the Congress is willing to let him do.
I mean,
right? So outright authoritarian doesn't seem to describe the Trump presidency.
So let me add two pieces of context. One is that in this original formulation, it was sort of talking about a shock and awe scenario where it's unambiguous authoritarianism after some period of time, right? You have the Muslim ban, and then things escalate from there. And instead, it's been softer moves against kind of traditional norms. The other thing, by the way, is like some of these undermining of longstanding norms has to do with the Republican Party as much or more than Trump himself, right? Like not confirming Merrick Garland, you can argue that, okay, well, maybe there's a precedent for that. Maybe it's setting a new precedent, whatever else, right? But that in some ways does more to undermine at least the traditional rules of the game than most things, if not everything that Trump has done. And these states where Republicans will lose the governorship and then have the legislature pass a bunch of laws or regulations to curtail the new governor's power, that's, I don't know if you call it authoritarian. It's certainly not terrific for democracy. And, you know, restricting voting rights, right? I mean, these things have sometimes not that much to do with Trump.
And even things that we'd consider to be norm-breaking, like maybe they're most evident on the international scene, are things that our system is designed to allow the president to do.
Yeah, and the increase in presidential powers has increased under all recent presidents, certainly including Obama.
Yeah, I'd go back to
the imperial presidency.
The way I phrased it originally, which is like, what this lays out, as Nate said, is sort of like a deliberate and discreet and shocking, unmistakable plunge into authoritarianism, which we haven't gotten. It's more like Trump just has these tendencies and those have slowly expressed themselves. But I think like saying, oh, we haven't gone outright into this state, if that was your only lens for looking at this part of this, you would miss a lot of what has defined Trump's presidency, which is these kind of strongman tendencies.
All right. So wrapping up here, we have group 5, Trump makes America great again. 13, Trump becomes Governor Schwarzenegger. And 14, Trump's button mashing works because the system really is broken. And that's the end of the list. So let's discuss those final two.
I mean, he certainly has become Governor Schwarzenegger, which is kind of this, he certainly is not owning the centrism or whatever at all.
14, the button mashing, I wouldn't say the button mashing has worked per se, but I would say that because the system is broken, a lot of button mashing doesn't really do anything. And so lots of life just goes on as normal.
All right. Summing up what we've gone over, all of these 14 different paths, what jumps out as the most prescient in terms of what the Trump presidency would end up being?
Okay. So we have a big, healthy dollop of number one, Trump keeps on trumping and the country remains evenly divided. None of the Trump changes direction, nothing from there. We have a big, healthy dollop of Trump is consumed by scandal. I think we have a medium-sized, I'll get a lot of pushback for that, a medium-sized dollop for Trump plunges America into authoritarianism, a word I can't pronounce, and a huge scoop of resistance to Trump from elsewhere in the government undermines his authority. And then finally, there's also a big helping of 14, Trump's button mashing works because the system really is broken. Not literally, but just in the sense that the economy is doing really well.
That sounds right to me.
How does that soup taste?
Voters will decide in 2020, Galen.
We'll decide.
All right, listeners, send us a picture of your Trump stew and let us know what course you think the Trump presidency has taken amongst those 14 paths. But let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
If the Trump presidency were a food, what food would it be? Thanks, Galen. Sorry.
It's a chili. I mean, that's a whole analogy here.
Beef stroganoff?
Some type of stroganoff or Super Bowl chili.
And before we go, I want to take a moment to thank our intern, Jake Arlo. This is her last week with us, and she's been wonderful to work with during her time at 538. In particular, she's been working with me on an audio documentary project that will come out early next year. So when you hear it, remember Jake. Jake, thank you. You did a tremendous job, and we all look forward to seeing what you do next.
Heck yeah.
We really do. We'll miss you, Jake.
We will. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. One last time, our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.